the two things that I think if you got these two things right, you'd get a lot right, is to automate your process. So if you think about human nature, kind of lazy, forgetful, we're sort of status quo prone, we can actually take that tendency and make it work for us if we automate our saving and investing plan. Automate that process to the extent possible, and you're going to use that human behavioral tendency to work for you rather than against you.
Welcome to the only show that simplifies the complicated world of retirement planning while embracing life beyond the numbers.
Expect clear insights,
accessible tools,
expert interviews,
and actionable advice,
empowering you to use your values as a roadmap to your ideal retirement.
No MBA required.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Retirement Planning Simplified. I'm Joe Curry, along with my co-host as always, Lindsay Wilson. How's it going, Lindsay?
Very well, Joe. How are you?
I'm great today. We had a guest we've been looking forward to having on the show for a long time.
Yes.
Dr. Daniel Crosby. There was a ton of good insights he shared. I think no matter where you're at, whether you're retired, close to retirement, or you're 20 years old, there's a lot that can be learned from this episode. We dive into behavioral finance and why humans are not really cut out to be good investors. So things to look out for. As you mentioned, there's about 200 and some different biases that make us not good investors. But we know we kind of tackled the top four. We looked at some other areas where advice comes in. We also talked about a new book he has coming out, Soul of Wealth, which I'm really excited to read. It doesn't come out until October, but that's going to be fun when it comes out. It's something a little bit different than diving into the facts around behavioral science and investing and talking more about, I think the way you put it, kind of being more mindful about money, thinking about how money fits into our life. And it's kind of like 50 some chapters, you know, different thoughts to ponder, I guess you could say. So anyway, I'm really excited about that as well. But for this show specifically, like I said, I think anyone can have a pretty big takeaway. And Lindsay, before you jump into his bio, I just want to make sure everybody sticks around to the end, because after the episode with Daniel, we have a way that you can get for free one of Daniel's books, The Laws of Wealth. So we'll share the details at the end of the episode. So Lindsay, let's hear more about Daniel.
Yeah. So Dr. Daniel Crosby is a psychologist and behavioral finance expert who helps organizations understand the intersection of mind and markets. His first book, Personal Benchmark, Integrating Behavioral Finance and Investment Management, was a New York Times bestseller.
Yeah. So he comes with a lot of experience, a degree of success, and I think you're going to enjoy this episode. Dr. Daniel Crosby, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Joe, good to be with you.
I'm really excited to have you on. You've put out a ton of good information on behavioral finance. So to actually get you on the show for our listeners is really exciting. So we'll jump right in here so we can try to get as much good information as possible out of you while I have you. So I mentioned behavioral finance. Maybe you could share some insights into how behavioral biases can impact investment decisions, especially with our listeners as individuals are approaching retirement.
Yes, it's a big topic. So I think a lot of times, the point I'd like to start to make here is a lot of times investors, when people hear that I work in finance and you probably get the same thing, people will come up to us and ask us about externalities. They'll ask us, what's the president going to do? What's the Fed going to do? What's the market going to do? What's the war going to do? What's the virus going to do? And it's all about sort of these external macro factors over which we have limited to no predictive power and no sort of personal capacity to impact them. When we look at the research, though, the number one predictor of whether or not you hit those retirement goals is really down to personal factors, you know, your savings rate, whether or not you're maximizing that human capital, whether or not you're taking adequate risk, whether or not you have good risk management procedures in place. So we tend to look outside of ourselves for the truth about how our investments will do. My message, the first chapter of that book is you control what matters most. I was intentional about the placement of that message. So the flip side of that is not taking responsibility for that or letting sort of these unarticulated cognitive biases get in the way is the number one impediment to us reaching our retirement goals.
Yeah, that's great. We could touch on maybe a couple of these areas from a bias standpoint. So maybe one is overestimating our abilities in life and in investing. Can you maybe speak a little bit to that?
There's four sort of primary meta biases there's over 200 different cognitive biases that impede our ability to make good decisions with our money, but that's sort of an unwieldy framework. We can't know and account for 200 different ways that we could mess things up. But one of the big four is one you just talked about, which is what I call ego, what is called overconfidence in the research. And overconfidence has three main facets. The first facet is we think we're better than other people. We see again and again, people think they're better than they actually are, think they're better looking, they're better drivers, they're smarter, whatever, on and on and on. People tend to overestimate their own abilities. That's sort of pillar one. Pillar two is we think we're luckier than average. So we think that good things will happen to us at sort of an unduly high rate. We overestimate our ability to, say, pick a good stock or win the lottery. And we underestimate our tendency to get divorced or get cancer or something like that. So this has obvious financial implications that leads people to take undue risk. It leads them to underprepare for divorce or bad health consequences and other things. And then the last piece is we think we have more knowledge about the future. We think we know what the future is going to look like more than we actually do. So you combine these three things, you know, we think we're better. We think we're more skilled than we actually are. We think we're more prescient about the future than we actually are. And we think we're luckier than we are. And you throw those in a bag and try and make good financial decisions with them. And it's pretty rough seas there.
Yeah. And I think that probably leads us to something called the behavior gap. Could you maybe speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, the behavior gap is just the delta or the chasm between what the market gives us and what we take home. I'll go back to that externalities thing. One of my favorite studies that I cite in the laws of wealth is that it has to do with the best performing mutual fund of the 2000s. So from 2000 to 2010, the US stock market lost money. Okay, so first decade ever where that was true. 10-year period, if you had bought and held the S&P 500, you would have lost money, which is a brutal run, very hard to do. This mutual fund over this 10-year period when the S&P got slightly less than zero, this mutual fund got 18.5% per year. So if you were to say to your clients like, hey, would you like me to put you in this mutual fund? They would go like, absolutely. I would love to have known what was going to do so well. But the average investor in this mutual fund actually lost money because what happens is the price would run up, like it would get in the news. People would talk about it. People would pile in. The price would go back down. People would jump out. They would go, oh, that was a mistake. It would go back up. They would jump back in, kind of rinse and repeat. So sorry for my US centrism here. You know, the market in the US has gotten about 10% a year over long periods of time. But sort of depending on who you ask, people have only taken home between 40 and 80% of that because of short-termism, being overactive, being emotional, and things like that. So we want to make sure we're minimizing that gap and getting all the good that the market's giving us.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. You mentioned taking risk when we're overconfident. Could you maybe talk a little bit about how risk tolerance plays into choosing our portfolio and our retirement planning?
Yeah, risk tolerance is, I think, a little misunderstood because the way we use the terms a little haphazardly, even in the industry. So we'll call it risk-taking behavior, has a couple of facets. One is your risk tolerance. This is your long-term, relatively stable preference for making risk-reward trade-offs. So this is how willing are you to take an extra measure of risk for an extra measure of possible return or possible loss, because there's not a perfect relationship, but there is a relationship between risk and reward. Okay, so that's risk tolerance. Next is risk capacity. This is how much risk can you afford to take? And this has to do with things like your level of wealth. Like all else equal, people with more money have more risk capacity. People who are younger have greater risk capacity because they have more years to bounce back. People who have more moderate goals, right? If your goal is to live in a mansion and drive a Bentley and have a private jet, that's going to constrain your risk capacity somewhat because your eyes are so big. So risk capacity is sort of how much risk can you afford to take given what you want to accomplish, given your age and given your level of wealth. The final piece, and the one that I'm the most focused on, is called a risk composure. So this is the short-term emotional component of risk. And it's the one that sort of is most germane to my work. So what's funny, and I'm sure you've seen this with the people you serve, is if you look back at like COVID, so March of 2020, the market's in free fall. People quite literally think the world is ending. We're all at home baking bread. So people who call you and say, hey, get me out of the market, sell everything, I want to be out of here. If you said to them, hey, is that smart? Is that what you should be doing? They would go, no, I know that this is not what you've told me to do. I know that that's not what I should be doing. That's risk tolerance speaking. That's that long-term preference. The emotional piece, the risk composure, is the thing that is screaming in their brain, though, get me out of here, I'm in danger. And that risk composure has overwhelmed that risk capacity and that risk tolerance. So we really need to consider all three things. Like, what's my sort of, in a cool, calm, collected emotional state, how willing am I to take risk? Because there's people like my wife who, on her best day, don't want to take a bit of risk.
Sure.
Like, emotions aside, on her happiest day, she still doesn't want to take risk. She has a low risk tolerance. And then there's other people who have a higher risk tolerance, but if they have a low risk composure, elevated emotion, they're going to be easily bucked off the ride by those emotions.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Now, is there anything that we've learned from behavior science that can help us when we're kind of trying to figure out where we fit in this framework of putting together a portfolio and how much risk that we should actually take on? How do we do something with all that information?
Well, I've built assessments around it that I think are pretty good. So there are, you know, there are certainly tools out there for taking this. Other people prefer a more conversational approach, like a conversation with your advisor around these three things. I think you can take a behavioral approach and looking at your past behavior. This is not a mind-blowing insight, but one of the truisms of psychology is that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So rather than asking people like, hey, how do you think you would respond to a 10 or a 15% drop? Just ask them, hey, what did you do during COVID? What did you do during the great financial crisis? How did you respond? How did you feel? That's a good insight. That's maybe more telling. So conversations, formal assessments, behavioral look backs, all of these things, I think, help approximate that information.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So with the risk composure, I think we're getting into the emotions of investing, right? So, and you talked a little bit about this in the behavior gap too, but maybe we can just go a little bit more into how fear and greed and different emotions can really impact our decision-making around our investments. And again, kind of focus into retirement too. I don't know if that brings anything different into it, but just kind of your thoughts on that.
The interesting thing, I'll preface it with something that's specific to retirement. What we're seeing now is retirement is a relatively new phenomenon. I mean, again, sorry for the US centrism here, but as recently as the founding of the US, which is only a couple hundred years old, the average life expectancy was 35.
Yeah.
200 years ago. Like if you made it to 40 or 50, like that was a good life. And the idea that you could hoard enough wealth to live decades without labor is entirely a brand new phenomenon that we're not really wired for. So one of the biggest things that I see is sort of a loss of meaning and purpose in retirement. There's really great models of human flourishing. And when you look at the things that make life worth living, work ticks a lot of those boxes.
Yeah.
Things like strong relationships, making progress, being a little more competent today than you were yesterday, working on a team, working for something bigger than yourself, doing deep work, being engaged, strong relationships, all those things are reliable indicators of how good your life is. And work ticks a lot of those boxes. Like we may not love work. Work is certainly frustrating in many respects as well. But there's a lot of sort of emotional scaffolding that work gives us that can be absent in retirement if we're not thoughtful about it. So making sure you have something to work on that helps you scratch that itch to be better every day, making sure you have those relationship groups and things like that that are helpful, making sure you have all those things in place, because if not, you run the risk of being extra emotional at a time where your support is gone. I think the other emotional component of retirement that can be difficult is for a lot of people, and I would certainly put myself in this camp, accumulation is very psychologically easy. Being disciplined, setting aside that money, seeing that number go up, that feels good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Watching that number come back down is a much harder thing. It's a difficult thing in retirement. I did research, a lot of it was with couples in Canada, but I surveyed hundreds of couples and I asked them, what do you fight about when you fight about money? And the number one point of disagreement was, is money best used to enjoy today or to plan for an uncertain tomorrow? And people tended to have very strong polarized opinions about that. So for people who are in the tomorrow camp, which is me, and many good savers, many people you enjoy working with, flipping that switch and watching that number go down is a profoundly difficult thing in retirement.
Yeah, we've had many full review meetings just on trying to give them permission to spend more money, like clients, because that's a paradigm shift once you get there. And it's not easy. I mean, it's one thing to talk about it, but it's another thing to actually shift that thinking. Now, are there any specific strategies or techniques that retirees can employ to kind of navigate the emotional challenges related to their investments?
Yeah, I give a bunch of sort of specific, more granular ones. If I had to speak at the highest level possible, though,
yeah,
the two things that I think, if you got these two things right, you'd get a lot right, is to automate your process. So one of the things that we know about human behavior is it's easier to work with a behavior than to work against it. So if you think about human nature, kind of lazy, we're sort of forgetful, we're sort of status quo prone. If you're like me, you've got all kinds of subscriptions that you forgot about and you're just getting billed by Netflix every month for this service that you may or may not use. That's because of status quo bias. That's because of laziness and forgetfulness. Well, we can actually take that tendency, which sounds bad, and make it work for us if we automate our saving and investing plan, like never even see the money. So just have it, whatever it is you want to do with it, whether it's to distribute it, to save it, to accumulate it, to invest it, automate that process to the extent possible. And you're going to use that human behavioral tendency to work for you rather than against you. Like that's number one. Number two is work with a professional. So an advisor here in the US, they work with about 100 folks, I'd say on average. The advisor has the advantage of, in addition to their formal education, living 100 financial lives simultaneously and sort of seeing what works and what doesn't work. Whereas the average investor has only their own experience to go by and has a very limited view. So people who work with an advisor tend to outperform those who don't rather dramatically. And the reasons for this are funny. It's not because advisors have any crystal ball into what the market's going to do. It's not because advisors are even particularly good at picking stocks or allocating assets. It's because advisors keep you from making a handful of catastrophic missteps over your lifetime that will make or break you. We find that that behavior gap that we talked about earlier is dramatically minimized in people who work with an advisor. So automate your process, get someone in your corner, and then a lot of this other kind of higher level stuff takes care of itself.
Okay. And I guess one of the keys for people being open to working with a professional is to understand some of those biases we talked about earlier, where we're maybe not as lucky as we think we are, and we're maybe not that much better at stock picking than the average person.
That's right.
That's great. Okay. One of the things that I did want to give you a chance to talk about too is you got a new book coming out, Soul of Wealth. So maybe we could just take a couple of minutes. You can tell us a little bit, kind of high level, what are you hoping people get out of that? And then maybe we can get a little more granular about if there's one or two key takeaways you're hoping people or readers pick up, what would those be?
Yeah. So I had written two books. I wrote The Laws of Wealth and I wrote The Behavioral Investor. Those were both really well received and sold well, translated into 14 languages. Really nice reception. But I had a long period of writer's block where I just kind of wasn't sure what I was going to write about. And it really came to me when reading Rick Rubin's book, of all things. So Rick Rubin, who was the producer who worked with Jay-Z and the Beastie Boys, all these folks, had this book out about creativity, about the creative act. And I loved the format of the book. It was 70-something chapters, all of which were about 3 pages each. And I found it a really compelling structure. In 10 minutes or 5 minutes, you could read a chapter, ponder a nugget of wisdom, and spend some time thinking and talking about that with someone you cared about. So The Soul of Wealth is written in a similar fashion. It's 50 essays about mind, money, and meaning. Whereas my previous books would touch on things like what to look for in a financial advisor, or sort of particulars about market structure, or how to choose a good advisor, how to choose a good ETF or something like that, this book will have none of that. I mean, this book is going to be sort of meditations on the good life as it intersects with money. So it'll be things like, how do you become charitable? How we could become better people and better parents by being humbled by the lessons of money. I got it sitting right here. Let me see what else I got. But it's 50 unique topics: the power of habits, emotion, comparison, what the uncertainty of markets can teach us about uncertainties in life. So this book is unique. I mean, it is about money, like it is about wealth, but I think you'll find yourself walking away from it, thinking about life more broadly as you read it. That's certainly my hope.
Okay, no, that sounds great. I mean, we've talked a lot of it on the show about the whole purpose behind, you know, why are we saving and retiring and what are we doing, and the importance of having an identity and some purpose beyond your work if you're going to move on, because from all the reasons that you said earlier about why work is maybe not that bad of a thing.
Yeah.
But I love this idea of kind of questions around money too, and how we're getting more purpose out of that. So I'll be sure to be getting a copy to work through with my wife. Having conversations about money sometimes with spouses can be difficult. So my wife and I are on very different wavelengths as far as our comfort in talking about money and things related to that. So that might be a good book for us to read together.
I think it would be.
Awesome. Just a couple more questions, and then I'll let you share where people can find that, when we can get it. When we're thinking about retirees, are there any kind of considerations when constructing a portfolio, when thinking about how it aligns with their goals and risk tolerance? I know we talked about some of these things, but when someone's going to kind of put their portfolio together, thinking about all the things we've been talking about today, what are some considerations?
Yeah, in addition to the stuff we've already touched on with respect to that, I would say one place people tend to get it wrong is that they live longer than they think, and they probably need to take more risk later in life than they might assume. So people will look at an actuarial chart and go, okay, well, in the US, the average male lives to be, I can't remember, 75 or whatever it is. And go, okay, well, I'm 44 now, so I got 31 more years. Well, no, because there's fat tails of that skewed. So if you've lived to be 65, there's a really good chance you'll live to be 90 or something like that. So I think people can over-index on actuarial charts and assumptions about when they're going to pass and cannot sort of fully anticipate longevity risk. I'll go back to that thing. It's truly the biggest thing I'm seeing with respect to psychology and retirement is if you retire at 65, again, that 65 number is from another place in time. We were retiring at 65 when people were living to be 65 on average.
Yeah.
You know, I have young children, and I read an article that said 40% of kids this age are going to live to be over 100. I mean, we need to be preparing for 100-year life. And as we continue to make medical advances and advances with AI and things like that,
yeah,
life's going to be longer and longer. It's going to be better for longer. And we need to be planning second, third, fourth acts, and not only preparing financially for retirement, but if we're going to be vibrant well into our senior years, how are we going to contribute? How are we going to grow? How are we going to get back? Because there is a real mental health crisis among retirees, many of whom who have planned quite nicely for the financial aspects of retirement, but who may have ignored the personal aspects of retirement.
Okay, that's great. It may be a good way to wrap up, but I'm going to throw it out one more question. Just everything we've talked about, no specific topic, but is there any other takeaways or pieces of advice you'd like to share with our audience? Again, kind of considering that our listeners are kind of in that 50 to 60 range, starting to think about retirement.
Yeah. The thing that I would say is, if you're interested in behavioral finance and this psychology of money thing, I think it is an opportunity for you to learn more about yourself. Parts of finance are a little dry, if I do say so. But I think this is a discipline where if you choose to go into these things and read books like mine and listen to podcasts like this, it's a place where your life can improve holistically. Like, you can become a better parent, grandparent, spouse, and you'll be better with your money, but you'll just be better at living. And that's what makes it such a rich discipline to me in kind of the most holistic sense.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. So I appreciate you joining us today, Daniel. Could you maybe just tell our listeners, where's the best place to find you? When's your new book coming out? And when or where can we get it?
Yeah, I mean, Amazon, let's put some more money in Jeff Bezos' pocket. So go to Amazon. Go to Amazon and pre-order The Soul of Wealth. I'd love that. And I have a podcast called Standard Deviations, and I'm on LinkedIn at Daniel Crosby, PhD.
Awesome. That's great. Well, I appreciate you joining us today. It's been fun. I appreciate all the insights. For all our listeners, if you just stick around a couple more minutes, we actually have a book giveaway, one of Dr. Crosby's books, and we'll let you know how you can get it. So thanks again, Daniel.
Yeah, my pleasure.
All right. We hope you enjoyed that episode with Dr. Daniel Crosby. As we mentioned at the start of this episode, we actually have a giveaway. So one caveat on that, Lindsay, to our listeners is that's going to be for our Canadian listeners. Sorry, everyone else.
Canadian listeners, sorry. Yes.
So if you're watching, you can see that I have his book, The Laws of Wealth, in front of me. We have 25 copies of Daniel's book, and we're going to give those out to our listeners. So I'm going to let Lindsay explain how you can get your hands on a copy of the book.
Sure. So you can be part of our RPS community or new to it. What we ask you to do is go to our website, retirementplanningsimplified.ca, and download a copy of our Navigator. That will give you an email that you can email directly, info@retirementplanningsimplified.ca. And you'll just email me and let me know that you would like a copy of the book. The first 25 people to email me, get a copy, and I'll mail it directly to you.
But that will be for our Canadian listeners.
Yes.
But anyway, a way to get your hands on that copy of the book. It's a great read, lots of great insights that just take everything we talked about in the episode today to another level. Thanks, Lindsay.
Thank you.
Investment services are provided through Matthews & Associates Investments of Aligned Capital Partners Incorporated, an approved trade name of Aligned Capital Partners Inc., ACPI. Only investment-related products and services are offered through ACPI/Matthews & Associates Investments of ACPI and covered by the Canadian Investor Protection Fund. Tax planning, financial planning, and insurance services are provided through Matthews & Associates. Matthews & Associates is an independent company separate and distinct from ACPI/Matthews & Associates Investments of ACPI. Matthews & Associates are not licensed tax professionals, and you should consult with your tax advisor before acting on any recommendations.
Visit retirementplanningsimplified.ca and join the Retirement Planning Simplified community,
where we explore the complicated world of retirement planning while embracing life beyond the numbers.
As a member of our community, you'll receive insights,
tips,
and the latest retirement planning tools
straight from us to you.